We're taking a pulse on the Wisconsin restaurant industry at this stage in the recovery. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. A survey by the National Restaurant Association, this was back in April, it found economic realities for restaurants in our state remain far from normal. And the thousands of restaurant operators who responded to the survey had a mixed outlook about sales growth into summer months. Have you started eating out again? What is it like? How is your favorite local restaurant doing? It's 800-642-1234. Dan Jacobs is co-owner and head chef of Dan Dan and Esther Ev in Milwaukee. Dan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning. Luke Zahm is here as well, chef and owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, host of Wisconsin Foodie and PBS Wisconsin. Luke, welcome back to you.
Hey, it's good to hear your voice, Kate.
Well, good to hear from you, Luke. Let's start with you. You know, it's hard to believe it's been almost 6 months when we last talked. How are things going?
Well, things are okay. I mean, we have had the luxury, Kate, of being obviously in a small town. During the pandemic, we felt like we were the gatekeepers. We knew that people came to Viroqua to experience the restaurant and the multiple farms that we have there as a touch point. So we had a really frank conversation at the beginning of the pandemic with our staff about the feelings of anxiety, the feelings of being on the front line, the feelings of keeping our doors open or closed based on the information that we could gather together. Now we're seeing a massive influx of people who just want to go out. They want to get through this phase in the pandemic. And we're really, really grateful for that, all of the support. But obviously, there's perils.
There are perils. We're going to get to that in just a bit here. Dan, can you bring us up to speed and where you're at with your restaurants and your approach to operations at this point?
Yeah, you know, it's a bit different than where we were like 6 months ago. You know, we're loosening up a lot of our things that we, you know, I'm not sure we ever would have loosened up, you know, looking back 6 months ago. You know, since the mask mandate was lifted yesterday, we're suggesting that people wear masks in public areas, but we're not going to, you know, enforce it at this point. It's kind of also come to a point where, like, I'm super tired of being the principal of a school that I don't want to be the principal of. Mm. I want to go back to doing hospitality, which is what I think, you know, I think we all do best. And it seems like, you know, for the most part, I mean, really like it's the 1% of people that aren't actually, you know, interested in following any sort of rules. But I think, you know, we're at a point now where, you know, people are vaccinated. People want to go out. We're seeing the numbers tick up every week, and it's exciting. But you know, we can't forget that, you know, 3 months of, you know, just killer service and having a lot of people in the door does not replace 15 months of lost revenue.
Yeah, certainly. And looking at that federal aid, I'm wondering, Luke, when you look at federal relief, there's the Restaurant Revitalization Fund that was written into the American Rescue Plan passed by Congress in March. Do you think that that is helping make up for that lost revenue from last year and doing it more equitably and making sure that money does trickle down to restaurants on Main Street?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a start. It really is a start. You know, $28.6 billion written into legislation definitely helps restaurants secure their basis and their standing in communities. But, you know, to be honest, I think that that portal was filled and that money was allocated in less than 2 days. What that means is there are restaurants that continue to exist without any relief. And you know, at this point, it becomes like the semantics of politics. Yes, Congress did something. They stepped forward. They put this bill together. They are helping the American economy. But the restaurant industry as a whole is still suffering. And it's really, really difficult. I think that there's a couple different parts. There's the financial strain, but there's also the psychological strain. For the last 16 months, we have a group of the American workforce that's been told that they are essential workers. and that they are vital to keeping the country's doors open and keeping our economies moving. And they're the front lines of public-facing industries. And now we have a situation where people aren't necessarily jumping up and down to go back to a $10 an hour job. And then we have markets even within the state. Right now, a starting dishwasher in Door County is making $17.50 an hour. Mm. Did you just hear that noise? That was like every dishwasher, available dishwasher in the state of Wisconsin, like packing their bags for the D.C. right now. It's incredible that we are still so short-staffed, and the money that was allocated through Congress, it just doesn't go far enough.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Luke Zahm, who is owner and chef at Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, host of Wisconsin Foodie. Dan Jacobs here, who is a restaurant owner and a chef in Milwaukee. We're discussing what the pandemic is doing to the restaurant community. Do you work at a restaurant? What's your position? What's it been like in these times? Are you struggling to hire employees? How has that affected your hours, your bottom line? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dan, you know, help wanted signs are posted in the windows of so many restaurants and food establishments all over the place. You had reduced staffing last year. Where are you at now?
We're starting to bring people back, and we're trying to do it in a real, you know, smart way. But let's be honest, you know, the labor shortage in restaurants wasn't. This isn't something new. The pandemic didn't really, it wasn't like brought about because of the pandemic. The pandemic just showed how bad it could be. We've already seen labor shortages in the last couple of years in Milwaukee for, you know, line cooks, you know, people just not willing to do that job of a dishwasher anymore, or, you know, not willing to start out as a server assistant. There's, you know, people want to go straight to, you know, being a server. So we've seen these things already. And I think the pandemic just kind of highlighted some of the fragile aspects of our business. We're back to about 60% of our staffing, and we're looking to add more. We're in a constant, I believe, state of hiring is what I like to call it. And people don't need to go to Door, dishwashers don't need to go to Door County. I will pay you $17 an hour to wash dishes in Milwaukee. So, like, it is. I mean, that's what we're doing. I mean, we completely changed how we pay people at Dan Dan because of the pandemic.
How did you change? Yeah. How did you change your pay structure? Explain that.
We moved to a service fee based system, which is actually 20% of every guest check, whether dine in or carry out, gets charged 20%. Yeah, it's automatic. We do leave the tip line, and we explain to the customer twice in the beginning of the meal and at the end of the meal that, you know, the service fee is on their check. If they feel like the service went above and beyond those expectations, please feel free to leave a little bit extra that goes directly to the front of house staff. But what we do is that 20% is spread out across the whole restaurant, so it's front and back of the house. So the front and back of the house are making between $44,000 and $52,000 a year full-time. And then anybody who's part-time is making $20 an hour. So, it feels like the right thing to do right now. You can do this. You can still make money. You can still run a business. And let's be honest, I mean, none of us got into restaurants to get rich anyways. I mean, we got into this because we love doing it. We love hospitality. We love serving people. And I think this gives our workforce the stability that they've never had. I mean, you're looking at a workforce that's dependent on sub-minimum wage and the generosity of other people to pad their checks. So, you know, some days on a Wednesday when it might be slow, server X might only, you know, might get cut early and might make $30. You know, you can't live on $30 a day, you know.
It's not predictable. Yeah.
It's just, you can't live on the generosity of other people. And I think, you know, it's time for this to kind of, it's been time for this to change. And I think we're taking the pandemic as an opportunity to kind of change how we do things. And we're not the only ones. I mean, there's other restaurants in the city that are also doing something similar to this.
Dan Jacobs in Milwaukee on the state of the restaurant industry and how to pay equitably. We also have Luke Zahm with us in Viroqua from the Driftless Cafe. Are you a restaurant worker who has had hours cut or been laid off in the pandemic? Have you received unemployment assistance? Are you a restaurant owner? Can you staff back up to meet the summer demand? Have you received federal assistance? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing pandemic recovery, the situation faced by Wisconsin restaurant operators. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Restaurants, they navigated the mask-wearing debate front and center. The city of Milwaukee's mask mandate ended yesterday following CDC guidance that said people who've been fully vaccinated can go without a mask in many situations. Restaurants, other businesses can still implement their own requirements. Do you wear a mask when eating out? What do you think of the wait staff wearing them or not? How have you changed your ways in dining out? How do you tip? 800-642-1234. Dan Jacobs co-owns Milwaukee Restaurants. Luke Zahm is host of Wisconsin Foodie and a restaurant owner in Viroqua. They're with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Luke, there is sentiment from elected leaders out there here in Wisconsin and elsewhere that cutting off additional weekly unemployment insurance money would push people back into the labor market, that the labor shortage is due to people making more on unemployment than they would make minimum wage or sub-minimum wage with tips. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think historically, whenever you push people up against a wall and put their backs to it and say, you either do this or you jump off, we've always got the best results. And that's complete sarcasm. I think, again, I'm going to go back to the fact that, like, for 16 months, this workforce sector was told that they are essential to the operation of the American economy. And now, you know, when things have started to loosen up a little bit, there is a little bit of trauma left over from that. I think it's a real knee-jerk reaction to say, hey, you know what, we're going to cut off federal unemployment benefits for this group of folks who have literally put themselves out there amid all the news of catastrophism and how terrible this pandemic is and how it's ravaging through communities. And we've watched the death toll rise. These people have dealt with this. They've internalized it. And now when we're at a situation where we have to rethink why we do what we do and how we do what we do, they're being told that, you know what, your feelings in this particular situation aren't valid and you need to go back to work so you can serve us again. I think that there's going to be a significant disconnect there. And that's why it takes restaurateurs like Dan, like folks who want to be more progressively minded, who want to rethink the financial paradigm that we face in the restaurant industry to grow forward.
Let's take a call on this. Russ is with us from Stoughton. Hi, Russ. What would you like to say about restaurants and how they operate?
Hi, good morning. My comment is about the problems with finding labor to come back to work. I think that busboys, waitresses working only on tips, dishwashers, you know, they have been historically undertreated and underpaid. And now that the pandemic and the economy are rising again, I think all of a sudden that the restaurant owners are resentful because they have to face reality that they never paid these people a working wage, I mean.
So Russ kind of sees this as a reckoning of sorts, Dan.
He's not wrong. It's just not 100% all the way there. Like, I think there's like Luke. Well, I mean, Luke kind of touched on it too a little bit. I think there's a lot of things that have kind of led up to this. I do believe that front of the house servers, busboys making sub-minimum wage depending on tips is incredibly unfair. And I don't think restaurant owners are upset about this. I don't think we're looking at this as our reckoning. I think it's giving us the opportunity to make a more equitable and fair change. I don't think, you know, I don't look at it this way. I don't look at it as, you know, I'm not mad at the situation. I think it gives us the opportunity to do something bigger and better. I've always said that if we end the pandemic and go back to business as usual, we have failed as an industry. This is our opportunity to do things different and to really create something new, you know, create an environment that this is being a server or being a chef or, you know, whatever it is in the restaurant. This is, it's a career path. Like, you can get paid like any other industry. You can get, you know, health insurance benefits, 401k, paid vacation time. I think that these things are important to everyone. And I'm just glad that, you know, we can finally start moving our industry in this direction.
Luke, do you see it that way, that this is a true turning point for the industry?
I think that this is kind of a pivot point for the industry. I mean, if as an industry, we just kind of collectively went back to like whatever it was we were doing before, you know, that's not going to work. What got us here won't get us there, so to speak. And I feel like that principle, honestly, as a business owner, as someone who employs people, is my mantra to live and die by. You know, we have really, really taken a hard look. I know that when I came on the show at the beginning of pandemic, we were going through this kind of existential crisis as a restaurant. You know, Ruthie and I were sitting down every day and asking, why do we do what we do? Why is it important that the Driftless Cafe stays open and solvent and viable and able to be accessed by people who come here? And now we're at this second crux point, like, okay, we understand why we need people to come in and experience these dining venues, why it's important to my farmers at the Driftless Cafe that we are vibrant and open and there, and we're rethinking how we do what we do. You know, being able to offer people a more competitive base salary, to be able to offer them, you know, all these amenities that they deserve, because they are literally, in a lot of cases, the heartbeat of a community. I think for us, you know, it kind of becomes simple. And this is the thing that the American public, like, has to hear a little bit. The days of eating low-cost food are ending. If we want this workforce to come back to work and feel empowered and feel passionate and feel like they are stewards of culture in our communities, food costs have to go up a little bit. The average margin that a restaurateur makes, like that you take home at the end of the year, and the national average is between 3% and 5% on all that money spent. That's not a lot of income, quite frankly. So we are going to take and redistribute that 3% to 5% to really, really bolster that employee workforce.
Dan, go ahead.
You know, we're the only industry that has not inflated its prices in 30 years. You know, we have every other industry, whether it's, you know, the airline industry, you know, if gas prices go up, tickets for your airplanes go up and you have no problem paying it. Whereas restaurants, we completely undervalue what we do and how we do it. For the sake of just being like, well, I don't know if the customer is going to pay, you know, whatever it is they're going to pay for this burger. I think the days of, you know, the customer's got to be okay with the fact that, yeah, man, in order to pay a living wage, in order to do all these things that, you know, and create a more equitable environment, the days of the $10 cheeseburger and fries and a pile of stuff it's not there anymore. Like, you have to be willing to pay, you know, you have to be willing to pay more. You have to be willing to pay $15 for that cheeseburger and fries that you used to pay $10 for. And yeah, maybe it makes going out to dinner a little bit more of a special occasion, which is also, again, I don't think any of these things, I think the pandemic showed how fragile our industry is. And, you know, I'm going back to it again. It's like, if we continue to do things the way we've done them, we've failed. And so we need to make some substantive changes. And I think one of them is the customer being okay with the fact that this is going to cost them a little bit more to go out to eat.
Yeah, so certainly some educating of your patrons and having that really frank conversation. So crystal ball time in our last moments here. Dan, looking ahead to the summer, what do you think it will hold for restaurant owners like yourself?
I think I actually do believe now. I think I've flipped my thoughts on this. I think we're looking at a very busy summer. I think people want to get out. They want to They want to do things. They want to, you know, experience, you know, being inside a restaurant again. I think the way we're doing it is safe. And that, you know, I really do think we're in for a busy summer. But again, I can't stress, you know, restaurants really need this restaurant revitalization fund money, and we need it refilled. Like Luke said, it's, you know, oversold by over $50 billion, and we need to refill this. You know, 3 months of good business is not going to make up for 15 months of just lost revenue every month.
Yeah, Luke, final thoughts in the a few seconds we have left.
Yeah, I think from Osseo to Ogdensburg, where I am this morning, you know, doing the foodie circuit right now and actually getting to talk and see with people, people are out. People are excited to reconnect with their communities. People are excited to reconnect with the cultural traditions that restaurants provide in our society. And I think it's going to be a banging year for people to be in the business and the industry. But you're going to have to be smart to survive it. And quite frankly, this is the place where we crank out amazing ideas.
Well, Luke Zahm and Dan Jacobs, thank you so much. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a veteran whose world opened up after joining the military.
Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha knew before she graduated high school that she wanted to see the world. She was ready for something different, for new experiences outside of her childhood home in Alabama. So she joined the Navy, traveled the globe, and made lifelong friends from many cultures along the way. Saylor's daughter, Erica Saylor, interviewed her about her experiences as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative.
My name is Lori McNeil Saylor. I am 59. I am also located in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I was originally born in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I moved to Mobile, Alabama after my mom passed. I was 4. And this wonderful woman named Alice adopted me. She already had 4 kids, my siblings. We grew up outside a lot, playing together, running around barefoot, just doing kid stuff. When did you enlist? I wanted to be somewhere other than Alabama. My thought process was I didn't want to go into 13th grade, as I put it, because I didn't want to go to school with the same people that I went to high school with. I wasn't really comfortable with a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. I was a lot shyer then. So when they came to the school, it sounded interesting and I signed up.
What was basic training like?
You know, it was so different because now you're living with people from all over the country. I think that's where my interest in learning about other people came from, because there were, I said, people from different cultures. And I remember this one young lady, she was just this tiny little curly haired blonde. And she asked me, "Can I touch your hair?" And I looked at her and I was just like, "Sure." And afterwards she said, "Why is your hair different from mine?" And I said, "Because that's the way God made it." And she was like, "Oh." It was so easy for her to understand that.
Is there someone that you served with you remember fondly?
My two most favorites are your Aunt Flo and your Aunt Trina, because I met one on the bus and the other one in boot camp. And we've been friends for over 30 years.
How do you think your time in the military affected you?
It opened my eyes a great deal as far as education, how to save money, just things that I hadn't really learned yet. You know, it gave me a lot of opportunities, you know, semi-free education, traveling. It definitely opened up my world and gave me the travel bug. That's the one thing I think is probably one of the most awesome things that the military did for me. I was there when they first put women on board ships. I was there when the Cold War ended, when Russia came to Norfolk, Virginia. I got to see that, you know, and I think I still have a Coke bottle with the Russian writing on it. So there are things that I got to see and experience that a lot of people don't get to do. So,
and you never would have.
Right. So I'm very grateful for the things that I was able to accomplish in the military.
Do you have any advice for someone who is interested in joining
I believe traveling, learning about other cultures, it's probably the best thing that you can do for your own sense of being. It helps you open up your mind and your eyes, and you get to learn so much. So definitely education, travel. And I always tell them, find someone you want to emulate when you first join. Find someone that you would like to be like, and you follow them around. You ask them questions. You learn from them. You know, just absorb it all. Make it worthwhile.
Right.
So I wish someone had told me that when I was joining, but I figured it out on my own.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
That was Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha, Wisconsin. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now to electric vehicles and whether this is the moment. Are we at a tipping point where sales of EVs will rival conventional gas vehicles? The recent launch of the F-150 Lightning has us wondering about Ford's approach. Do you want an electric car but worry about the charging options? Do you hope that the F-150 could change the industry? 800-642-1234 to join in. Jamie Page Deaton is executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. Jamie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. So we're wondering, with the F-150, people talking about whether this is the next chapter for electric, that this is one for the record books. Why should we care about this truck?
Well, this is one we should all care about because the F-150 is the best-selling vehicle in the United States. This is something, you know, Ford sells thousands of these, tens of thousands of these every year. It's a major profit center for Ford. And so the fact that they're confident enough to make it an EV speaks volumes about where Ford believes the industry is heading. And it also makes it an easily adoptable EV for a lot of people. You know, I think folks will think, oh, EVs, they feel like golf carts. They're small, they're cheap, they don't have very much power. But with the F-150 Lightning, what Ford is proving is, hey, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have a fully electric vehicle that can tow, that can haul, that can go off-road, that is really, really fast. And so this is something that I think a lot of, you know, analysts within the industry were all really watching, because if Ford sells a lot of these, what you're really going to see is a little bit more of a tipping point towards EVs in the broader culture. It's not going to be just about the early adopters. You know, it's going to be about mass market, regular everyday consumers driving EVs.
Well, tell us about the staying power of the F-150. I mean, this has been the best-selling vehicle in our country for 40 years, like from the Reagan era. Why has it stayed on top?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that a lot of the sales are fleet sales. So okay. A lot of businesses really like this truck. But there's a lot of reasons, too, why businesses would go after the F-150 Lightning and maybe switch their fleets over to electric fleets. But the other reason is just that, you know, the F-150 has come in at a time when Americans just want trucks. Trucks have really evolved from work vehicles to lifestyle vehicles. And now if you get into an F-150, a gas-powered one, particularly if you go for some of the upper trims, they're luxury vehicles on the inside, and they're comfortable enough to drive every single day. And they're also, like I mentioned before, they're major profit centers, not just for Ford, but all truck makers, you know, the Chevy Silverado, the Ram 1500. Most of the trucks that people buy now cost well north of $60,000. And they're just gold mines for the automakers because, you know, the features that are in those trucks, the gas-powered trucks, aren't that expensive. So it's pure profit for them. But for most buyers, you know, a truck can do family duty. It can do daily duty. It can do date night duty because the interiors are so nice. It's just, if the last time you were in a pickup truck was, you know, back in the Reagan administration, you know, take another look at them because they're not your grandpa's trucks anymore.
Well, you know, Ford disclosed last week at its investor day that like 70,000 F-150 Lightning pickups have been ordered in the first 7 days it was available online. I mean, that would seem like pretty strong demand.
That's absolutely huge and very strong demand. Now, just to be clear, like the reservations, they only cost $100 and they're fully refundable. So if you change your mind later, you know, you can get your money back. But, you know, what's interesting about the F-150 Lightning is, you know, it's showing up, you know, by the numbers, there's not a lot of compromises. And when it comes to trucks, there are buyers that are really into, you know, their brand. Like I'm a Chevy truck buyer. I drive a Ram. I drive a Ford. But there are also buyers that really look at it by the numbers. And the Lightning comes in on par with not just base level trucks, but also the high performance trucks. So the base F-150 Lightning makes 426 horsepower, which is huge. But that is also in line with the Ford Raptor, which is their high performance truck, that makes 450 horsepower. Now, if you get the extra battery, the higher trim on the F-150 Lightning, you'll get 563 horsepower and 775 pound feet of torque. That is really, really a lot of power for towing and hauling and a lot of speed. This thing does 0-60 in 4.4 seconds. Well, wow. You know, to put that in context, a base Porsche Carrera does 0-60 in 4 seconds. So you're talking 0.4 of a second slower than a Porsche. Now that's the base Porsche. The higher end Porsches will do it a lot faster, but that's a truck moving really, really fast. And it's got the towing and hauling capacity of, that's very similar to a gas powered F-150. So this is something that Ford has really developed to appeal to truck buyers. And even if they're a little bit hesitant about, you know, an EV powertrain, if you look at the numbers, it's in line with what you'd get with a gas powered truck.
Yeah, they're going head to head. Barry from Spooner on the issue of hauling capacity. Barry, go ahead.
Yes, I read up on the Lightning and they released everything, you know, how many miles it could travel on a charge, basically on an empty truck. But in cold weather, when you're hauling 5,000 pounds, you know, you're a firewood or something like that, how long is it really going to drive?
So the ranges that they have include hauling. They don't necessarily include like the cold weather and things like that, but you can expect usually when the weather is cold to take around 10-20% off your range on an EV. And so the maximum total payload on the F-150 is 2,000 pounds. And that's on the extended range model. And then that's on the base model. And then it's 1,800 pounds for the extended battery because the battery, adds some weight to that. And so you can expect to get, you know, with the, you know, extended battery, if you're hauling 1,800 pounds, you can expect to get around, you know, 250, 230 miles of range there. The other thing that's really cool about it is Ford is putting scales in the bed. So you'll know when you've hit or come close to your payload capacity. I don't know if you've ever seen going down the road, people who have obviously too much in the back of their trucks. Like that's not a risk with the F-150 Lightning.
So Barry, what do you think? Are you a pickup truck owner now?
Yeah, actually I own an F-150.
Oh, you do?
And I use it as a truck in northwestern Wisconsin. So I'm very concerned about, you know, on a 0-degree day, I'm out in the woods collecting firewood, that it's going to go 200 miles. It's going to go 100 miles.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly being out in the cold, extreme temperatures would be on Barry's mind. And certainly, Jamie, something to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as we get, you know, kind of more real world testing and real world numbers coming out from this. So this, you know, the F-150 Lightning is due as early as spring 2022, Ford says. Personally, I think that's optimistic because there's a major, you know, chip shortage within the new car industry right now. But if you're a buyer like Barry and you're interested in it, but you're also concerned on if it's going to work for you, give it a year or two, because in a year or two, we're going to know a lot more. You're going to be able to hop onto owners forums and ask like, hey, I haul firewood, well into the North Woods. You know, is this truck going to work for me? And you'll be able to get a real world answer there.
Jamie Page Deaton, executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. As we look at the future of electric vehicles, Ford is signaling it's going all in on EVs. Are EVs the game changer for replacing conventional gas and diesel vehicles? Do you manage a fleet? Would electric trucks make sense for your workforce? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Ford says it plans to invest more than $30 billion in electric vehicles and battery technology by 2025. It announced last week it plans to transition an estimated 40% of its annual sales volume to EVs by 2030. Are you in the market? Have you taken an electric car on a road trip? How was it? Still time, 800-642-1234. Jamie Page Deaton heads up the U.S. News Best Cars team. She's with us for about 10 more minutes. Jerry is joining us from Viola. Hi, Jerry. What would you like to say about electric vehicles?
Well, I've owned a couple electric vehicles. Once you go electric, you'll never go back from just a performance standpoint. There is some range anxiety that I did experience. I own some businesses, and we are transitioning to electric. It's a slow transition because they are expensive. But I wanted to ask the guest, is China dictating where the U.S. car companies are going? I mean, what I've read is that all U.S. car companies are selling more cars in China than in the U.S., and China is saying you're going to have to be electric. So is that forcing U.S. car companies to go electric? That's my question.
Jerry, thanks.
Yes, Jerry, that's an excellent question, and it's absolutely true. The U.S. used to be the largest car market in the world. We've been overtaken by China, and so there's a big push in China for electric vehicles. So automakers, you know, have to, if they want to sell cars in China, they need to switch over to EVs. And the result is that the products we get in America are also switching more over to EVs. You know, and it's not just the case too with EVs. You'll also see a lot of features in American cars that a lot of Chinese buyers demand. So for example, you know, after 2008, the financial crisis, a lot of people were surprised that GM kept Buick as a brand around. Well, it turns out they kept it because Buick is extremely popular in China. And a lot of the really nice Buicks that are on the road today, like the, you know, they are, and like the Avenir trims that are super luxurious, those actually came out of the Chinese development. And we're now benefiting from it. But it's not just China that's really pushing automakers towards EVs. A number of European countries have announced that they're going to require EV sales, you know, past a certain date. A number of European cities as well. So this is really a global shift of governments outside the United States pushing automakers towards, you know, different types of powertrains, you know, away from the internal combustion engine. And that the result is, you know, it doesn't make sense for car companies to create cars that are just for the U.S. It's not efficient for them. And so we're seeing kind of the globalization of auto fleets. And the result is we're seeing more EVs in the United States.
Jerry mentioned some anxiety, some range anxiety. And, you know, we often hear about the higher cost than gas power. There's, you know, issues around battery production emissions. Are these concerns warranted?
Yes, I think to a degree they are. Now, the first, you know, is cost. You don't want to get an EV if it's going to cost you a lot more than a gasoline-powered car. And the EVs do tend to be more expensive because their development costs are more expensive than a gas car. You know, it's expensive for automakers to figure out this new technology. But what we're starting to see is prices really starting to come down on EVs. So for the F-150 Lightning, which is only available in the crew cab model, you know, for the crew cab configuration, so it's a four-door, it starts at about $39,000 before any tax credits. Well, a gas F-150 crew cab starts at just over $36,000. So there's about a $3,000 difference before any tax credits. And so it's very likely if you go for the base F-150 Lightning, for example, you'll pay less than if you paid for a gas model. And so you've also seen the same thing, you know, the mini electric actually costs less than the gas model. So we're starting to see those prices come down. When it comes to range anxiety, though, that is a huge issue. The charging infrastructure in the United States is not particularly good. You know, it's great for Tesla owners. Tesla did a great job. And one of the reasons that they had so many rapid adopters is because they built out their own charging network. You know, the rest of the car companies haven't done the same thing. It's kind of a patchwork of private charging companies. You can certainly make it across the country on an electric car, but it is more challenging than in a gas car. But, you know, what I think a lot of buyers, you know, need to keep in mind is that on their daily driving, if they're driving less than, you know, 200 miles, which the vast majority of people are, and they have, you know, a home where they can charge, that's where the majority of their charge is going to be. It's a little bit of a mental shift to remember, okay, my gas station is in my house. Mm. And, you know, if you're really concerned about emissions at the tailpipe, then, you know, for your road trips, go ahead and rent a gasoline powered car. And then on your, you know, for the 1 to 2 weeks, you know, a year that you're on, you know, the long road trips, but then have, you know, the EV for your daily driving. That'll do a lot to cut down, you know, your carbon emissions. But you also raise a really good point about, you know, battery manufacturing. These batteries, though they're shifting, they're starting to shift away from this, the majority of EV batteries are being made with rare earth minerals that are mined in places without a lot of environmental controls. There's concerns about the workers in these mines, you know, being, you know, not treated very well. Mm-hmm. And then the actual process of creating these batteries can be quite dirty. And then there's also the issue of battery disposal at the end of the EV's life. Overall, though, you know, it's just overall, the EVs do tend to be cleaner because, you know, there's also a lot of problems with drilling for oil and refining oil and then, you know, expelling carbon as you're driving it. So it's just, I think, you know, it's a personal choice that people really have to look at, you know, look at the cost, look at how you drive. You know, if you're routinely driving, you know, on a long road trip every week, an EV is probably not for you yet until the charging infrastructure catches up. And if you're really concerned about, you know, the emissions process or, you know, the process of creating the batteries, then, you know, it's probably not for you yet until that gets cleaned up. But ultimately, it's, you know, up to every individual buyer.
Yeah. So really examining those trade-offs. As we talk with Jamie Page Deaton, executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team, Paul from Richland Center on the topic of a gas station in my house. Paul, go ahead.
I just have a question related to that idea of the charging station. I'm all in favor of electric vehicles, whether it's a truck or a car, but in my particular town, we have only two public charging stations. Well, people aren't going to go to a parking lot and recharge. They're going to want to put it in their house, and you just can't plug these into a garage outlet. So how much does it cost to put in a charging station for either a truck or a car? And can local electricians, do they have the knowledge yet to even do that? And I guess that's my question, is about the charging aspect of it.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. So you might be surprised at how little these charging stations actually cost. In fact, Ford's, if you buy the upper trim of the Lightning, they'll give you a charging station and then you just pay for the installation. And, you know, I don't know about the cost of charging stations in Wisconsin, but I'm based in D.C. And so I'm going to guess that it's less expensive in Wisconsin just because things, you know, cost of living here is a little bit more expensive. And I've been researching a charging station for my own house. The charging station itself runs about $600. And then any licensed electrician can actually install these. They're not that difficult. It's on par with having a 240 volt outlet installed in your house. So if you're getting a, you know, a dryer outlet basically installed, that electrician can do it. And around here, you know, it takes an electrician about half a day. And so, you know, you're looking at, you know, $600 for the charger and then maybe another $600, you know, for installation if it takes the electrician 6 hours. Those are DC prices. The other thing is, you know, you may have local and state tax credits and tax breaks and incentives for installing these charging stations in your house. And, you know, to the other point, too, you actually can plug an EV into the outlets in your house. It'll just take a super long time for them to charge. I've plugged many EVs that I've tested into the, you know, 110 volt outlets in my garage. It takes a good 24 hours to get a full charge, but they can do it. You can also just plug them into a regular 240 volt outlet. So if you have like an old dryer outlet in your house, you can plug them in. It just takes a lot longer to charge them at that point. But they draw about as much electricity as a refrigerator.
Jamie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jamie Page Deaton is executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. This is the Ideas Network.